Welcome to Bridge the Gap with host Josh and Lucas, a podcast dedicated to informing, educating, and influencing the future of housing and services for seniors. Powered by our supporting partners, NHI, TSO Life, NRC Health, Erdman, Sherpa, TIS, and R-Care. Find out more about this podcast at btgvoice.com.
Welcome to Bridge the Gap, the Senior Living Podcast with Josh and Lucas. We are here at the EFA conference and we are excited. The day is starting to kind of hit a little bit of a wind down before the rest of the groups are going to hit their parties. But right now we have some esteemed guests. I want to welcome David LaPlaca, is the VP of Capital and Design, and also Sarah Soler. She is the Senior Director of Design and Project Management at Senior Lifestyle. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Josh, we have another interesting topic on design trends, design project management. There's a lot of different issues that we've been discussing today here at EFA, and we're going to start to highlight how design takes place at a large operator.
Yeah, exciting. So we're basically at the mecca of design for senior living and aging services at Environments for Aging. Had a great discussion with you guys just prior to the podcast. I'm looking forward to my mind being blown because you guys just do it all, it sounds like. So, Lucas, maybe just paint a little context here.
Yeah, I think we would love to, before we dive into some of the details, starting with David, give us some of your background. Obviously, it's in architecture, but you could have gone and worked at anywhere. You guys live in Chicago. It's a huge, booming city for design, but you've chosen to use your talents for senior living.
Yeah, that's right. So for 20 years, I was an architect in Chicago. My areas of focus were senior housing and boutique hotels. So our largest client at my firm was Senior Lifestyle. After knowing them very well, knowing their product, knowing what was expected in design, Justin Robbins reached out to me and said, I would really like you on this side of the table so that you could help guide our projects and our capital at Senior Lifestyle. So in 2010, I switched, moved over, and then continued to run their capital projects, bringing a level of hospitality to the work, not just healthcare, right? And then go from concepting the projects, budgeting the needs, and then requesting those from our investor groups.
Uh-huh. Interesting. And Sarah, what about you?
I am an interior designer. And I started out in hospitality. David and I actually met working on a project together, the Hotel Felix in Chicago. And then I had my own company for a number of years and was looking to make a change. And at the same time, David gave me a ring and made a job for me that I couldn't say no to. So I oversee design and push design and manage all of our sort of walls in project, if you will, from conception through completion with our internal design team and also external teams. And along with David, figure out budgets and scoping and all of those things for long-term planning.
Josh, we see this a lot on the show when we listen to people's backgrounds, is that typically people, senior living seems to find them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And so which brings a different perspective, a unique perspective. So with that outsider perspective, now insider, what do you think are some of the major differences between hospitality design and senior living design?
It's sure. That's a very current topic, right? You've had senior housing kind of lumped in with healthcare and nursing homes and things of this nature, when really our residents are just older human beings that want nice environments, that want to live in a home-like experience. So we want to bring that to what senior housing could be and should be.
Yeah.
See, the other difference is that hotels are very transient. So someone comes into a space, they experience it for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, and they leave and they don't come back. Or maybe they do in a year because they had some nice memory of it. Our guests, if you will, stay much longer. They're very vocal, and their needs are different. And so, and also very similar, right? They want a range of options to have choice about the things that they do, but we have to spend a lot more time cultivating what those are and really figuring out the details and the dynamics of those things because of the more permanence of the residents.
Yeah. And Josh, you as an operator, I mean, you get to see the complexities of what it takes to reposition some of these assets. You know, David and Sarah, you guys are in even a much different type of situation where there are REITs involved, there's different outside investors involved, even from private equity, not necessarily public, which creates another level of complexity to not only budget, but execute the projects from CapEx to design to renovations. Can you give some insights into how that process is and how you've been able to use your outside skills to come in and manage that?
Yes, most definitely. You know, as managers, you start to understand what the needs are of your communities and what work you need to do in the coming year for the residents. So we drill down, we analyze all the capital projects that would expect it to be occurring at the community next year. We need to scope those projects out, but we also need to figure out what those budgets should be. So with our background, it's helpful that we've got experience in construction and costs. We have got a great network of contractors and other providers that we can use for some short-term back-of-the-envelope budgeting, but we can also rely on historical data that we've done in prior years for those projects. So Sarah and I will go through all the community files with our other support team members on the design side and our regional directors of plan operations. And we'll come up with the list of projects, if you will, that we would like to present and execute the following year. We need to present then capital budgets every year to our investor groups for their consideration and hopefully for their approval. So the tighter we can be with scoping, the more accurate we can be on cost, the more likelihood that we will have a tight budget to present, and hopefully one that will be approved by our ownership group.
So I would add there's also some strategy to that in terms of if we understand that, you know, a certain community may have a greater need, we can sort of address what's the short-term immediate need and what can wait that we know we're not going to get all of the money that we need this year, but we can phase that over a couple of years to still impact and improve, but also be conscious of cash flows and sort of appetites for spend.
Yeah, so I think it sounds like we're talking a little bit about maybe project improvements of existing assets and things like that, communities, and identifying the things that we need, maybe the things that we want, maybe the things that will position the property better to function or to be marketed or just from a hospitality perspective. But in that process, so you talked about the budgeting and making sure the costs are really tight and you're going to present to the stakeholder group, the ownership group. In that process, have you found that the design and the concept needs to also be present with the numbers at that phase? Are you actually doing conceptuals, or is that only just a financial budgeting exercise at that point?
So we'll do sort of loose planning, mm-hmm. sketchy hand planning, if you mm-hmm. will, because ultimately, you know, what sofa A looks like mm-hmm. in the end doesn't, we know the general cost of that. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really need to know that it's going to be a blue sofa with a rolled arm and a, you know, accent welt. Like, none of those things matter at the early stages of getting approval. We just need to know that it's a sofa. We need 5 of them. We need whatever it is that we need mm-hmm. in that space. And we can budget accordingly and work out the design pieces later.
But what is impactful is, will we be tearing out a whole coffee bar
yes.
and building a new bistro? What sort of construction and reconfiguration will be necessary to make this successful? Mm-hmm. So that's where you do, again, a little bit of design planning just to figure out very schematically what that might look like.
How do we want to reorganize space?
That's right.
What are we trying to support better that's not functioning right now? And how do we execute all of that, both from construction and FF&E?
Well, you know, what's fascinating here is, you know, the process that you guys are going through over and over and over and over again at a broad scale. There's a lot of our listeners out there that are perhaps trying to figure out, oh gosh, what do I need to do first? I know I need to do X, I need to do Y, I need to do Z, I need to budget, I need to sketch this out. When you're making these presentations for these ownership groups, these stakeholder groups, what kind of pushback are you getting? What kind of questions? What are they interested in seeing? Is it just the raw numbers, or are they wanting to see return on investment, or what are they wanting to see?
That's a great point. There are two basic types of projects that we present: a maintenance CapEx, which is sort of the year-over-year spend to keep the buildings warm and dry, and that is usually we budget a dollar per bed multiplied by the number of beds in that portfolio, and that usually isn't that contentious of a request. The other is more of a revenue-enhancing project. So the larger that those become, the more we need to show a payback, a return on investment, sure, and roughly stated an ROI-type project. Mm-hmm. So we'll need to work with our asset management team, our VPs of operations, our sales and marketing, and determine if we renovate to this extent, what will be our new basis point for rent? And what kind of payback, what kind of timeline will that need to be? So if we do come with something that's much more robust and a larger ask, we will definitely need to do some internal metrics to see what that payback will be.
Sure.
And it's much more attractive to them if we can show some definite cause and effect.
Sure, yeah. That makes a lot of sense. So is there a certain point, it sounds like even on that latter example that you were given, there's a lot of team involved in helping formulate that kind of that package and the ROI and all that. Is there at any point, you know, that part of that team and that equation, what are some of the other players? Is, I'm assuming, some cost examples and things like that. Do you have to get a general contractor involved? Is it subcontractors or things like that that you're getting involved to buy into that process and help you with that cost estimate?
I think that depends on the project. Some of it, we again have historical data, even if it's not an all-inclusive project that makes up the sum of that. We can take parts and pieces from other projects and apply those numbers appropriately. And then other times we do get some base bidding to help formulate that number, depending on, again, what the scope is.
Sure.
Yeah, we won't really have drawings to send out to market at that point, but we'll work with a trusted partner and say, you know, what have you seen in the marketplace for this sort of scope and this kind of construction cost? Because that's really where we need additional help at times.
Yeah. Josh, we've seen in the NIC map data that the nation's inventory of buildings are really kind of at that 20-year mark. Mm-hmm. A large majority of the buildings are what I would categorize as a legacy community, right? They were built in the boom of the 90s and the early 2000s, and they are a perfect candidates for repositioning, remodeling, and renovation. A large portfolio that you guys manage probably fall into that category. What are you seeing as challenges or opportunities in that particular sector as a new demographic starts to come in, and even the existing population are saying, you know, I guess you have to look at, are we marketing to the adult child? Are we marketing to our resident? How do you balance those things?
That's right. I think, Sarah, I think you'd like to talk about who you would market to.
Well, it's all of them is the answer. There's not just one group, right? We have to meet the needs of many masters, if you will. So we have everything from the adult child to the resident, to our C-suite, to our investors, to marketing, to the staff.
Sounds complicated.
It is complicated. So, you know, we get input from everybody in the appropriate doses, and we control information pretty carefully to not overwhelm anyone with things that are sort of outside of their spectrum, but we'll spin them out because we want to keep people focused on the things they're supposed to focus on. And then we take all of that information and really apply it to what is the budget, what is the scope that we can accomplish, and how can we best meet all of those needs within the context of a given project or long-term or longer-term planning.
You know, when we talk about those buildings that are 20 years old, that are in markets that might be saturated, and you've got a new competitor coming in, so we have to think about who is going to be our resident. Is it the current people that we have now and their socioeconomic range, or are we going to strive for something larger? Can we ever compete with a brand new build? Because if a new player comes in the market and puts in a pool and puts in 7 different food and beverage opportunities in the building and things are on bells and whistles all the time, then we really can't go for that because our building is limited in size. we might have a benefit because our apartments are much larger than a new build, which is usually the case. And we do have the benefit of long-term staff and reputation in the marketplace, which is very valuable. But it really does come down to who are we designing for from a resident perspective and who are we going to have move into our communities. So we have to focus on that, center all of this around who that is going to be, because ultimately they're moving in, their rent is going to then subsidize the renovation. So that's an extremely important part to then convey to the investors, along with all the other collaboration with all the other team members, to get to that point where everyone's on board and it makes sense.
We'd also say that we also have tried to, as much as we can, consider who's the resident 10 years from now, because the reality is when we get millions of dollars to put into a community, it's not likely that they're going to see money like that for quite some time again. And so we have to maximize it for today, but also for down the road a bit.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I would love to talk a little more on that topic, because you guys are involved in obviously a lot of projects and you're very forward thinking. What are the conversations around design and planning for the next generation? Because they're not here yet, but, you know, especially on a lot of projects, we know, especially the sizable projects, when you're doing kind of new and cutting edge things and forward thinking, sometimes through the process, I mean, you know, those things are a couple years away and you're really kind of starting to design for the next generation. So what are some of those unique differences that you guys are thinking about that may look different, you know, tomorrow than it looks today, that you could shed some light on?
Sure. I think that change always happens a lot slower than we'd like. Mm-hmm. And so trying to balance out what is comfortable for current residents and residents in the next few years versus what the next generation of residents are going to want is a delicate balance, because the next generation needs and the current generation needs don't, right? That doesn't quite feel comfortable to either generation. And so we have to bridge that for now as we look towards all of these different things that are coming out into the market that have a lot of promise, but also need some real life testing.
Sure.
And then, you know, our projects, we manage all of the renovations for the active buildings in our portfolio. So we have a development team that does ground up, but to retroactively go in and fit in some of these new technologies and new systems is not as easy and not nearly as cost effective as with new construction. So that is a challenge to work through as well.
So do you guys see that as, you know, I think on the one hand, there's always two sides to every coin. There is a lot of aging inventory out there. I think a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, how am I going to stay relevant? How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? But then there's another group that's out there that's like, wow, you know, there's this huge opportunity to go in and reposition older assets and to be able to make this community stay relevant for a long time. Kind of what's y'all's feelings on that? Are you more on the positive side or more like, oh gosh, we got to design a whole new product?
Oh, I think it's understanding what the marketplace where your building resides is asking for. So if you do have an oversaturated market and you look to your resident who's coming in, what are the reasons why they maybe aren't choosing you? Mm-hmm. So what is that list? Mm-hmm. So is it activities? Mm-hmm. Is it a pool? Is it a dog run? Is it outdoor events? Mm-hmm. These are the things that we can then quantify and decide, can we bring these things to this community successfully, or do we just move past that?
Sure.
So understand what the market's requesting. To reposition, again, it's can you successfully do that to then make your building much more attractive than the other options that are out there? So a comp analysis is definitely necessary. If you're going to now reposition and add a new market type, a memory care or assisted living where it doesn't exist currently, you'll need a market study to make sure that that makes sense and is viable to invest money into that. But knowing what the end game is desired, evaluating that, and then analyzing it. Do we move forward in that direction or this direction? And usually it becomes pretty clear once you really start to pin all those points on the chart.
one of the recent things that we heard on a panel was that the actual market penetration for seniors housing is really only about that 5 or 6% mark. And that historically it's really kind of maintained there, which creates, begs a question. You know, it's an incredible opportunity to reach a bigger marketplace. Since you guys have been a longstanding top 10 operator, do you find that the other operators in that category are your main competition, or do you think it's the home is your main competition? And as you look to the future, what is Senior Lifestyle looking at to, I guess, you know, go after these types of opportunities or threats?
So the home, yeah, for sure. And I think that a lot of what we try and do that speaks to this generation and the next is offer socialization, right? And so if that's planned socialization or organic through design, we provide spaces that build for both functions so that we can have activities programming, but we can also create spaces where residents can, you know, have a book club or a sewing circle or whatever it is that they want to do, but naturally create some of that socialization and have spaces that are multi-generational that, you know grandkids are coming in and you know adult children are coming in and they're going to be checking their emails while they're talking to their mom and talking to a caregiver and all, you know, we all are highly multifunctional now.
Yeah.
And so really looking at those types of opportunities, because those are ongoing. Those are human needs that don't change from generation to generation. They just shift a little bit in terms of how we engage. And so those spaces become flexible and those things become flexible, but we have to still offer that and create that so that, you know, that is what people are losing at home in terms of isolation, and that's where decline starts to happen is when people are isolated.
We have to make them see that if it's just a pure swap, live at home, live in a community, then that's a hard sell. But if you can then layer on a better quality of life with interaction, with friends, with new friends, with other needs taken care of and needs for the future that we can plan on, assisted living, you know, that kind of healthcare, then it becomes a much more attractive proposition to them. And if it's an equal monetary, and now you have all this additional psychosocial behavior that will make your life better and last longer, then that's our goal, is to really convince them of that this is the right thing to do.
Well, that's fascinating. So you may have just answered my follow-up question to Lucas's, which was kind of, what do you perceive as the greatest threat? And I think you mentioned the home is definitely something. You mentioned some ways that you can kind of combat that or overcome that or the selling point. But what do you think is the greatest opportunity for us right now as an industry when we look at where we are right now, where we're going or where we could go? What do you guys think about that? What is something we really should be capitalizing on that maybe not enough people are talking about?
Well, I would say you have to really figure out what the value points are so that you can make sure that you're developing or repositioning to appropriate level that's attractive, but also that is cost effective. Because if your rates are too high, it could be the most beautiful place ever. But if within that market, it's just outside of, you know, the socioeconomic realities, people will look, but they won't come. But if you can balance all of that thought and design and really do it intentfully and execute it well with the understanding of where the market is supposed to be, mm-hmm. you'll be in a much better position.
Excellent. Very, very cool.
Well, this is great, guys. This is really good information and a lot of fun to sit down here and talk about. There's incredible thought leadership taking place here and a lot of classes and courses. And I think it's really important for the industry to know that the people that are working in, designing and also maintaining the communities that people live in are here being educated and learning and collaborating together. And I find that to be, a rewarding process and a lot of fun, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We're having a blast here. It's been great talking and hearing everybody's different perspective and what people are involved in and how they're tackling challenges. I know our listeners find such great value. We get great feedback from things like this. When people are looking at tackling a project and looking at the steps and the processes, having this valuable information that we take straight to their podcast listening platform is incredible. So thank you guys for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting
us.
It's a lot of fun. And to our listeners, check us out at btgvoice.com. You can get all of our information and connect to our social pages, and we'll make sure that we pump all this out there. Feedback. We want that feedback. Rate and review our show. Go to iTunes and give us that 5-star rating if you really feel like it. If you want to give us a 1-star, just pass it up. Don't do that.
We want the 5-star.
We don't
want
to see that.
So thank you for listening to another great episode of Bridge the Gap.
The podcast team wants to hear from you. If you're on Instagram, let us know your takeaways. Take a screenshot of the show you just listened to, tag BTG Voice, and we might just share your thoughts. Thanks for listening to Bridge the Gap.